Levitt and Dubner, not a law firm, a freak firm. New book out, authors of Freakonomics. Think like a freak. This is actually going to retrain your brain to be more freakish. Not going to work with me, I'll tell you, I'm already there. But, Stephen J. Dubner is on the phone with us from Chicago. What are you doing in Chicago there, Stephen J. Dubner?
Not going to work for you.
What?
Not going to work for you, you mean, because you're already there?
I'm freaked out, man. I was a freak before it was fashionable.
Well, you just saved yourself $25. You don't need to buy it.
I didn't buy it. They gave this to us. Yeah, and actually, it's $28.99, which is really something.
I was shy about saying the real price because it's so much.
Yeah.
But usually, you can find it at a discount, yeah.
And higher in Canada, too.
Well, you know, they have Canadian bacon, so you got to lose somewhere.
I know. How are you?
I am great. How are you?
Good. Are you on the
road? I love your show. It's really fun to be on. I do love it.
Well, thank you. Are you on the road promoting now, the book? Or?
Yeah, we were in New York for a few days, and then Washington, and I'm in Chicago now, then we head to California, then to England. So it's like a little miniature. Yeah.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
Is that the Royal We? Is that the Royal We, or does Levitt actually go out with you on these things?
Yeah, Levitt goes out with me. I learned, you know, book tour, like the first time I wrote a book and got to go on tour, I was thrilled because the idea of anybody showing up to hear you talk about your book was great. But now I've learned that you can't spell torture without tour. It's
really?
It's a long couple of weeks, yeah, but it's fun.
Yeah, no. Don't you love it when you take a train in the middle of the night to a place and sleep for 3 hours and get up and do a morning show and you don't know what city you're in? That sort of feeling?
Yeah, a little bit.
Yeah, that's a great feeling. The freak thing, it's really a franchise now for you guys, right? I mean, this is like freak time. Still freak time.
People call it that.
It's a juggernaut.
I think it's something shy of a juggernaut. It's a freak or not.
Yeah.
It's, you know, honestly, I love that people think that because I think we're so slow. It takes us 4 or 5 years to write a book. But then we do this public radio podcast that comes out weekly, Freakonomics Radio, that I think gives the illusion that we're busier than we are.
Yeah. When you say we all the time, do you mean you? He's actually the guy, right? Let's admit it. Levitt is the economist, right?
Yeah,
he's the freak. Yeah.
Yeah, he's much freakier than I.
He
I'll
is.
Be honest with you. I'm pretty normal. Yeah.
In what sense do you mean?
I mean him being a freak?
Yes.
So, you know, honestly, if I had to define what, the most important thing of thinking like we do, you know, so there are a lot of steps to it that we go through in the book, and a lot of them, honestly, are pretty common sense and have to do with just thinking generally, which people don't seem to do very much. But I think one element that really sets people apart is that you have to learn or be born with, but not many people are born with it. You have to learn to really not care so much about what people think of you.
Yeah.
And that, I think we all think, you know, we march to our own drummer and so on, but honestly, it's very hard. And
it's tough.
Some of the stories we tell in the book illustrate that, you know, when it comes to trying to get a lot of people to do a good thing, whether it's, conserve energy or treat the environment well and stuff, you know, we've gotten this idea that moral urging and incentives are really powerful, but in fact, they don't seem to work very well at all. So you can tell people this is the right thing to do and you should do it, and people will nod their head and look you in the eye and be really earnest, and then they go home and they fire up the, you know, coal-powered whatever they got.
Yeah.
And but it turns out that the herd mentality is actually a really strong incentive. People fall right in line as soon as their friends and family are doing it. And I think that illustrates kind of the downside of it. It's really easy to do what everybody else does, and it's hard to think on your own.
Yeah. So you've launched totally into the book now. You launched right into it. You
went
through
all the way past it.
You're up to number four now because I made a list of all the incentives. Conventional wisdom is not always right. Don't care what other people think. So you're up to four now, which is
kind of like a
correlation and causality. Do you want to go right to that, or are you?
I'm a little bit like a trained monkey, I guess.
Let me ask you this, just before we get into it heavy here. Now, Paul Krugman again mentions not you. He doesn't mention you. But mentions Levitt again. Did you see that one recently?
Oh no, that's pretty typical though. What did he say today?
Well, it was on May 16th. When was that? It was a couple days ago? I don't even know what the date is. He said, Noah Smith isn't very happy with Steve Levitt, who thinks he was being smart by telling David Cameron he should scrap the NHS, the health service in England, and let the magic of the marketplace deal with healthcare. Strangely, Cameron wasn't impressed. And then he goes on, he says, I think there are actually several things going on here. One is a Levitt-specific or maybe Freakonomics-specific effect, the belief that a smart guy can waltz into any subject and that his shoot-from-the-hip assertions are as good as the experts. Respond.
That sounds pretty Krugman-y. Krugman loves to hate on us and a lot of other people. Krugman's a, I don't know why he's so upset about so many things. He seems to have a pretty good life. He's got a cat, I know. I've seen him have a picture of him with his cat, and they look very happy together. So, I will just say this to set the record a little bit straight.
Yes, go ahead.
We did have this meeting with David Cameron. We didn't tell him that he should scrap the NHS by any stretch, but what Cameron said to us was, hey, I'm about to get elected. This was a few years ago, and we don't have any money in our government. You know, we're way, way, way down. And this was during the early days of the recession. Mm-hmm. And he said, so I'm going to have to cut a lot of stuff, but there's some things I just will not touch. And so we asked him what, and he said, well, the NHS, National Health Service.
Right.
And you know, I understand why. It's beloved in the UK. Now, so we did advise him that he should consider changing the way that healthcare is provided to some degree, not scrap it, because, you know, when people don't pay for something, when it's kind of paid for already, at least at the point of contact, you tend to, you know, overconsume it and stuff like that. But the strange thing is, you're right, he did not really take our advice to heart, seemingly, and that meeting was one of the shortest meetings we've ever had with any prime minister, although it was the only meeting we've ever had with a prime minister. But I will say this, in the intervening years, he did exactly that. He did actually tighten up spending on healthcare a lot, which I think probably makes Krugman upset, because Krugman is, you know, quite a fan of government spending, and I think he defends that real well. And I think government spending can work great in some circumstances and much less than great in others.
Yeah. He also brought up the thing about the solar panels not being black. You know,
he's still talking about that.
Levitt said it's climate change. It's counterintuitive but solar panels are black, so they actually will absorb.
Yeah, this was
more
a small. This is a small part of a large argument we made about 5 years ago. Which again, I would.
But
say,
did he think they were black? I mean, that's a big oversight, actually.
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, I think that blackness in a solar panel is the question. Although I don't know why it should be. But the point there was from this fellow Nathan Myhrvold, who's the kind of energy guy and physicist and cookbook guy. I don't know if you've ever seen his modernist cookbook, this 800-pound. Five-volume set of cookbooks, but
no.
Nathan Myhrvold, we were talking about climate change and the many problems, and this gets back to actually the moral thing I was talking about a minute ago. If you expect that we can just tell everybody around the world, hey, you should use less energy because it's dirty and it's polluting and it produces greenhouse gases, which may start to really overheat the planet, you understand why that's a good message to send, but the point we're making is that is not an incentive that most people are going to respond to. So you either need to get pricing into it and charge people a whole lot to pollute, or try to think about fighting the potential for climate change in a different way, and just hoping that people are going to go along and sing kumbaya and follow the moral instinct it can be a fool's game.
Yeah. What do you think about this guy, Thomas, is it Piketty?
Your guess is as good as mine. I certainly know the book. I don't know. Yeah.
He's everywhere now. He's the current darling of economics, I guess. And everyone's quoting him. And do you know him at all? You don't know him at all?
I don't know him. I know his work, and I know that my co-author, Levitt, I believe, took a class with him at MIT years ago.
Oh, he did, yeah.
And I think Piketty, pardon me, I don't know how the pronunciation is. I think it's phenomenal that he has written this book that's got this conversation going. Conversation being, you know, who gets rich over history and why, and which I think is a great conversation. My concern is that while there's a lot of data and a lot of argument in the book, it quickly devolved, as is typical, into a kind of political argument as opposed to an argument about economics. So you've got those on the left, including Paul Krugman, I believe, who thinks that this is exactly right, and the prescription is right, too, which is we need a wealth tax. And then you've got those on the right who say, even if the prescription is right, you can't claw back money that people have earned. And so what's the interesting underlying argument has quickly been superseded by yet another political fight. And as we've seen, once you get to the stage of the political fight, usually nothing happens.
Yeah, but when you're talking about disparities of wealth, I mean, that's inherently political, though, right? So you can't really get away from that.
You know, I disagree. I think there's a way to reframe problems like that. So I think there's a way to frame a problem like what we call income inequality. First of all, a lot of this stuff happens in the naming. Like, you know, how the death tax, sometimes the estate tax, depending on who's talking about it.
Right.
So I think that if you could talk about the fact that some people make a whole lot more money than a lot of other people, and that's okay because some people work harder, get lucky, whatever, but that the central thrust should be, wouldn't it be great if the people on the bottom could earn more? Then it's fine. Then I don't think it is inherently political. It becomes inherently political when you talk about taking from one group to give to another.
Mm-hmm.
So if I could reframe it as an apolitical argument, I'd love to do it. I don't think we're that good. But I think that the minute you get it to a political argument, you know that you're not going to move the needle very far.
Yeah. Don't you think it's somewhat the extent of not making more money? Some people make more money than others, but if you make more money at the expense of other people, then that's...
Yeah,
you could call
absolutely.
That political, but it's sort of analytical, maybe.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. Look, I'll give you, for instance, where I think it's... Here's a tax that's, I think, pretty hard to defend, a low tax. So, you know, carried interest tax. So for hedge fund, private equity, really. It is true that if you're in an echelon where you're making a lot of money from a lot of what most of us would think of as non-traditional ways, in other words, not a salary, right? It is true that it is really easy to pay a relatively low rate of tax on a huge amount of money. And I've never really heard anybody defend that except for the people who do it, who make that money, and for the people who help them write that legislation. So I think there's a lot of room for fixing things, but if you turn it into a big 30,000-foot political fight that, hey, rich people are bad and poor people deserve to kick them in the shins, that, I think, is the bad argument to have.
Yeah, and not well stated. I mean, if you could state that, the same idea, a little more elegantly, then I think you'd have something.
Yeah, agree.
All right, so now let's come back to Freakonomics, which is not really an economic philosophy so much. It's sort of guerrilla economics, right? I mean, you pick things all over the place, and do unexpected takes on them and rethink those particular. But it's not a generalized philosophy of economics, correct?
That is very much true. I think the only part of it that's truly drawn from, you know, mainstream economics is the belief that, you know, incentives really matter and that people respond to incentives. But, you know, it's easy to say that. It's more complicated because there are different kinds of incentives. Financial are real, but there are social and moral incentives. And people don't always respond to incentives the way that you think and hope. So a lot of plans, whether they're by governments or families, don't work out the way you think they would.
And in fact, a lot of incentives turn out to be disincentives.
They do. You come up with something that you think is brilliant, that you think is going to get people to do exactly what you need them to do. Then it turns out that all those people out there are gaming the system on you and exploiting your incentive and sometimes boomeranging it on you.
Yeah.
It's hard.
Were you guys called in at all on Obamacare? Did they want to get your take on what they were doing and how they were approaching it?
Not yet.
If they were, what would you have said?
Well, look, I'll be honest with you. I think there are a lot of people involved in crafting Obamacare who are extraordinarily shrewd about how markets work, whether it's for healthcare or anything else. But I think that they also, they're so shrewd, including Obama himself, I believe, that they understood that the politics were kind of more important than the economics of it. And I understand that. Politics often trumps economics. It's not a coincidence that we've never elected an economist to the President of the United States. In some ways,
wasn't Wilson one? Something like that?
I'm pretty sure he was not. He was the president of Princeton, I know. Yeah. I thought he was something like an historian, but I'm not sure.
Oh, maybe he was, yeah.
Yeah. But, you know, the fact is that our healthcare system, and this is certainly not an easy thing to do,
yeah.
but it doesn't, you know, I think what all the smart people agree is that it would be great if the incentives were really aligned up and down the line of healthcare. And the problem is that there's a lot of incentives to fix people once they're broken and not much incentive to help people stop from getting broken.
Yeah.
And then once they get broken or sick, then the costs are extremely high because the incentives have kind of shaken down that way because of the reimbursement from the insurance firms.
Yeah.
And also then if you're a person like me who has the fortune to buy my own health care at a very high price, but I buy it, then once you have insurance that covers almost anything, you tend to consume a lot of it as opposed to if you're paying for some share of it, you know, a la carte. So there's a lot of ways in which the current system is at odds with basic economics. On the other hand, I think if there's one realm of modern society that economics has a hard time fixing, it is healthcare.
Let's change gears slightly here. King Solomon and David Lee Roth. Compare and contrast.
There's very little contrast. They're so, so similar in so many ways.
Are they?
So, absolutely. So first of all, both Jewish. David Lee Roth, King Solomon we know is Jewish. David Lee Roth actually learned to sing while preparing for his bar mitzvah. They both got a lot of girls. In the Bible, says King Solomon had something like 500 wives and 700 girlfriends. And
yeah.
David Lee Roth once said that he slept with every girl that he met with two legs and even once with an amputee. So a lot of girls.
Thanks for throwing that in.
My pleasure.
Yeah.
They both wrote the lyrics to number one pop songs.
Yeah.
David Lee Roth for Van Halen wrote the lyrics to Jump, their only number one hit.
Yeah.
And King Solomon reportedly wrote the Book of Ecclesiastes, which was adapted first by Pete Seeger and then for a song that the birds sang, Turn, 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 the number one hit.
He wrote that.
So, yeah. You know, we don't know for sure, but King Solomon is thought to have written at least some of many books of the Bible, Proverbs and Ecclesiastes and Song of Songs. And then what they most have in common is that they use game theory to be smart.
They were both freaks.
There you go. It took a while, but I got to. Yeah, they're both freaks. So
okay.
Yeah.
Game theory, tell us about that and how it affects being a freak.
Okay. So game theory, very simply, is anticipating your opponent's next move in order to make your next move a little bit better. Mm. And it doesn't mean not necessarily about beating someone. It can be to do something good for society. It's about how you plan your move so that you anticipate what everybody else is going to do out there.
Right, and this is politics now at this point. That's what politics is, basically.
I guess so. I guess that's true. I hadn't thought of that, but I think you're right, yeah. So King Solomon, the most famous story about him, he was a young king. He wanted to show his wisdom. He quickly got a chance. These two women who were prostitutes, actually, lived in the same house, came to him. They said, one of them said, we both had babies. Mine is right here. The other lady's baby died, but she stole mine in the night. And now she's pretending that mine is a dead one, right? And that hers is alive.
Hmm.
So what do you do? So King Solomon has to figure out which lady is lying. So he says, okay, I have the solution. Bring me the sword. I will cut the baby in half.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Give you each half of it, right? That's the famous story.
Yeah.
And so the one woman says, no, don't cut it. Just give it to the other woman. And the other woman says, cool, go ahead, slice it. So King Solomon says, you, the one who said, don't harm the baby, I know you are the real mother because you would rather the baby go to the other woman than be hurt.
Yeah.
So that's a clever little trick, right? David Lee Roth, allegedly, according to David Lee Roth, was even cleverer. Do you remember the story, Michael, about the brown M&Ms that Van Halen...
Yeah, oh, sure, and their rider that they...
Exactly, yeah. Right. Yeah. So there's this famous contract rider, 53 pages, where they said, you have to give us this food, this lighting equipment, da-da-da. A lot of it had to do with their big, complicated set with the lights and sound and stage and so on. And then on one page it said, in the munchies section, absolutely no brown M&Ms. And for years, everybody thought that was just them being, you know, prima donnas. And as it turns out, according to David Lee Roth, that was not the reason for it. The reason was they were concerned that their whole stage setup would not be done properly and safely with all these huge lighting towers and the stage and all the audio equipment. Mm-hmm. And in every town they went, there was a different promoter. And they didn't. There was no way they could guarantee that each promoter would carefully read the rider, the all 53 pages, and make sure they'd taken all the safety precautions. So he set up a trick. He buried this one little Easter egg in there, the brown M&Ms. And when they'd get to a new arena, according to David Lee Roth, the first thing he'd do is go backstage where the food was, look in the bowl. If there were brown M&Ms that hadn't been picked out, he would know that the promoter had not carefully read the rider, and now they'd have to go and seek out, look at the other equipment to make sure that was all right.
Interesting.
So again, like King Solomon, kind of used a clever trick to let the truth float to the surface.
Yeah, almost brilliant. Close to being brilliant.
I think so. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Okay, well, that's a good one. And as far as now the freak side of that, what is the freak side of that? That's all game, freak game playing?
Yeah, a little bit. You know, we call this strategy teaching your garden to weed itself.
Ah.
In other words, it'd be great if, you know, the bad people or guilty people out there, when you have a, let's say you're looking at 1,000 people and trying to find out the 3 or 4 who are bad, it'd be great if they came forward and said, yeah, you know, I'm the bad guy. But they don't, obviously. So you try to think of a way, a little game, that you can teach, encourage the bad people or whatever they are to identify themselves through some way. So we write about all these different kinds of stories where people have figured out how to do that, including one that that we worked on in the UK to try to flush out terrorists using banking data.
Mm-hmm.
And in a previous book, we'd written about this algorithm that my co-author Steve Levitt had worked on with a British banker, a fraud officer at a British bank. And in that second book of ours, Super Freakonomics, we kind of planted one of these brown M&M tricks,
mm-hmm.
which was we listed all the things that that would identify a potential terrorist in the banking data, and then said one thing that they almost never do is buy life insurance from their bank, because why would a terrorist buy life insurance if he thinks he might blow himself up? It probably wouldn't pay out.
Right.
So this plan of ours, sorry?
A bad investment.
A very bad investment.
Yeah.
Absolutely right. So this plan of ours, we got quite attacked in the UK when we talked about it, because they said, why would you go to all the trouble to come up with this algorithm and then tell people how to evade it just by buying life insurance? Well, the fact of the matter is the algorithm was already in place looking at banking data, and in the light of the publicity from that last book of us talking about why terrorists should buy life insurance, who do you think had an incentive to run out and now buy life insurance from the bank?
Yeah.
Only the people who might wish to evade the trap. And so
saying that only terrorists buy life insurance.
Only terrorists buy life insurance from the bank whose data we were using, because I don't know if you or anybody in your audience has ever bought life insurance from a bank. They sell it, but that's not where most people do buy it. But you could also look at the timing.
I had no idea.
We were seeing a rash of people who were buying life insurance shortly after we were out there getting hammered for this in the book.
Yeah.
If they were among the people whose markers already indicated that they might be bad guys, then that was kind of the cherry on top.
Yeah, well, that was actually good. I like the idea of a garden, not just weed, but the garden that can harvest itself. I always thought, you know, the pick-your-own-strawberries model is a brilliant thing. You can pick your own corn, for example, just to keep it on agriculture level, and let people come and pick their own corn, and you wouldn't have to do any of that. It would be a tremendous cost-saving.
Cut your own Christmas tree.
Yeah. But the strawberries, I think, is the best. You know, what a great idea. The farmer's sitting there in the garage, and he's handing out baskets, and they're picking all his crops for him. It's ideal. What a model. Well, there's so much here, and we really don't have too much more time to talk about it, but there's the incentives, know what to measure and how to measure. And this one, I think, is important. Conventional wisdom is not necessarily conventional nor wisdom.
That's right.
Yeah. So are we looking here mainly for unconventional wisdom in this whole approach of the freak approach?
I guess so. I mean, a lot of what we advocate is just really helping people to think for themselves, to learn. You know, we say you should learn to say, I don't know. You know, we're all so quick to assume we know the answers to things. We encourage that people think a little bit like a child sometimes, because we do get that curiosity and wonder kind of beaten out of us. Then we also talk about the upside of quitting. You know, we do have this, I mean, America's done amazing things in part because we have so much stick-to-itiveness, but we also believe in this gospel, you should never quit anything. If you do, you're a total failure. And we ask people to reassess that, to look at, you know, when's a good opportunity to give up a project or a job or a relationship. And you know, we find that oftentimes there's a real gain to be had from that if you can get past the feeling that you're a failure for quitting, that we try to find ways to fail better, fail fast, fail more frequently.
Yeah, there are good reasons for quitting.
Yeah.
The child thing I always like, because you end up telling your kids, stop asking so many questions. But that's what we need to start doing ourselves, is start asking so many questions.
I would say so. I mean, they do get a little obnoxious sometimes, but we love them.
Yeah. No, but it's good for the soul to raise children, because you have to answer some of those questions at least, and it makes you think about things you've taken for granted. So that's, I think, what you're saying here.
Makes you realize how little you know sometimes too.
Yes, or you wouldn't have kids in the first place. It's called Think Like a Freak. Levitt and Stephen J. Dubner we're speaking to today. Thank you, Stephen, so much for taking the time to talk with us.
Pleasure. Thanks for having me.
It's been freaky. Think Like a Freak. Levitt and Dubner. That was Dubner. Okay.